Mr. Bates.
Good morning.
May it please the court. This case comes before you on the granting of the defendant's motion to dismiss in the district court here in the Northern District of Illinois. It concerns U.S. passengers suing a U.S. Airlines, Delta, related to compensation for canceled and delayed flights. Because these incidents occurred in Europe, there is no dispute that European law applies, specifically a passenger's rights law, European Union Regulation 261. There's also no dispute that under basic tenets of European law that rights created by a statute, such as EU 261, are privately enforceable in courts. So the question becomes, what courts can those rights be privately enforced in? And more specifically, does EU 261 contain an exclusivity clause, a form exclusivity clause, mandating that claims for compensation under that law can only be brought in an EU member state? And turning to the case at hand and the statute at hand, the analysis begins and ends with whether or not there is an express prohibition in the statute.
Why does it need to be expressed?
There is a long precedent which dates back to the formation of the courts that the jurisdiction of the courts will not be deprived by implication. We cite...
Well, it's not a jurisdictional issue in the ordinary sense of the word. It's really a question about whether this claim is cognizable in a non-member state.
Correct, but it's still it's approached from a jurisdictional perspective in the sense of we cite the Federalist paper, Alexander Hamilton. Back when our federal courts were first being created, he was grappling in Federalist Paper 82 with, okay, we've got these courts. What's their jurisdiction, and what is it vis-a-vis the state?
We have jurisdiction under the Class Action Fairness Act.
Correct.
Okay, so it's not a jurisdictional question. What we have is a substantive question about whether this claim under the EU regulation is cognizable in the courts of a non-member state, and that doesn't depend, it seems to me, on an express exclusivity clause. It can be implicit as well. There's no rule of law that says that it can't be implicit by virtue of the structure and the way that the provisions in the EU regulation work together. So maybe you could get to that. It's really not a jurisdictional question.
Okay. Well, I would disagree on. There's two points there. There's one, are we looking for an express, or do we go down the road of implicit? And then two, if we are going down that road, does one exist here? As we stated in the briefing, and again, if I go back to the Federalist Paper 82, Hamilton says there that the federal courts of the U.S. can adjudicate a claim based on local law or a law from a foreign nation.
Right. This is not a conflicts of law question or a choice of law question either. You need a cognizable, recognizable claim under American law before you get to a choice of law question. And if there is such a cognizable, recognizable American cause of action like breach of contract, some tort, etc., then a choice of law question may arise to determine what rule of law applies. But we're not in that choice of law domain.
I agree, Your Honor.
So,
but I still want to point out that under the Galveston Railroad case in the Supreme Court, the Federalist Paper, and the other cases we cite in the brief, the courts start their analysis by looking to see whether the statute has some prohibition on adjudication outside of a certain form. If we turn specifically to EU 261, it does not have any section that specifically relates to jurisdiction. There's no prohibition or restriction as to any specific tribunal or court that a civil action can be brought in. It does deal with administrative actions and draws a dichotomy between the two. So what the defendants have done is gone down a road of trying to cobble together a restriction on where civil actions can be heard by looking at provisions that are not addressing jurisdiction and, frankly, adding words to the statute that aren't there. If you look at their argument, they lead with the argument that in paragraph 22 of the whereas clause is at the beginning of EU 261, that a reference to national law actually means national law and courts of an EU member state.
Are you saying an individual would have the ability to bring a lawsuit here as opposed to a class group, just one person under this law?
Yes. I mean, this is a putative class action, but the class action context is not a relevant consideration in terms of the initial question of whether this is a proper venue.
Well, it's the only reason, frankly. You wouldn't do this if you couldn't make a class action out of it.
In terms of the choice of forum?
Yeah.
I disagree, Your Honor, in terms of my client's choice between suing a U.S. corporation in their hometown of Chicago as opposed to traveling to Europe. It's a much easier choice.
under a European law.
The European law attaches because of the location of the...
But they don't do class actions over there.
In Europe, actually, they have a variety of... Some of the nations have no collective actions. Some have some collective actions. Portugal has class actions quite similar to the U.S. There's a variance among the member states in terms of how they approach collective actions.
Of course, if the individual plaintiffs were to sue on this theory in state court, they couldn't sue the federal court because they wouldn't get to the diversity amount, right?
Correct.
So they sue in state court, and you run head into the Airline Deregulation Act, don't you?
No, Your Honor, it would seem
to me that the ADA would certainly preempt in that circumstance because it would be a state legal proceeding that would interfere with the federal scheme.
Actually, I disagree on that. The ADA preemption preempts laws. It's not a jurisdictional. It doesn't preempt
preempt court action?
Correct. It preempts the laws. For example, in this instance, ADA preemption doesn't apply because this is under the Supremacy Clause. U.S. law, U.S. federal law is not supreme throughout the world. It's only within the United States. This is a European law. Therefore, it's not preempted. If it were a U.S. law, there's an exception.
So why are these state torts preempted by the ADA?
Because the ADA preempts any state law.
So
other
bringing,
than
bringing of this action in state court would be a matter of state law that would be preempted by the ADA.
If it were premised on a state law. But it's not premised on a state law. It's premised on a European Union law. Preemption relates to laws.
Well, we're not communicating about that. I think the state court action, the state court proceeding, would be considered interference with the ADA.
Actually, I disagree because, for example, under Wallens and the ADA, there's an exception for breach of contract claims, which are state law claims. That state law claim under breach of contract could be brought in federal court or state court.
Right, but the district court held in this case that this EU regulation is not incorporated into the contract of carriage, and there's no contest about that on appeal.
Correct.
So
correct.
You've accepted that. So this is preempted as a contract cause of action.
Correct. What the court ruled, there was no contract action, is what he truly ruled. He didn't have to get to the preemption.
Right.
But again, turning to defendants' arguments, their primary argument relates to the word national law, which appears in paragraph 22 of the whereas clauses. And this clause basically just says that EU member states need to set up administrative proceedings to regulate the airlines, make sure they comply with the requirements and sanction them if they do not. And then in doing so, it says that these administrative proceedings, I mean, to quote it, the supervision should not affect the rights of passengers and air carriers to seek legal redress from courts under procedures of national law.
Right, so that has to refer to national law of EU member states because only EU member states are instructed to set up these informal administrative proceedings.
But
there's no other way to read it.
But it's not a mandatory jurisdictional provision.
It doesn't have to be jurisdictional. We're looking for some cognizable cause of action in U.S. courts. It's not a question of jurisdiction.
It's not if we don't use the word jurisdiction, it's not a mandatory statement requiring the choice of a specific tribunal. It is It is within the context of saying you need to set up these administrative proceedings. They're not going to impact anything that happens in the courts. And it's
but by implication, it's a statement that these claims are cognizable only in EU member state courts. That's the argument, and I think you're not really grappling with that.
I think if the EU wanted to say that these claims are only cognizable in EU member state courts, it would have said
so. Okay, that's just an argument for the necessity of an express clause, and I don't think there's anything in the law that requires an express clause to that effect, an express exclusivity clause. This is a necessary implication of the structure of the treaty. That's what the district court held. And that argument you're not really squarely grappling with.
Well, again, we have a fundamental disagreement in terms of the precedent on the express, but setting that aside, if you look, the structure that the district court is looking at is because the statute sets up administrative proceedings. Any statute, any law that sets up administrative proceedings are going to be limited to the home jurisdiction because a legislative body cannot set up administrative proceedings outside of its jurisdiction. That's a separate context than courts. As we state in the briefing, if one approaches the law from this perspective, U.S. courts are no longer going to be adjudicating any foreign law claims. And they've been doing it for centuries. We cite the Kalmich case in the Seventh Circuit from the 80s.
I don't think that's an implication of an affirmance here. The affirmance here would address this particular regulation and simply stand for the proposition that this kind of claim is not cognizable in American courts.
But it would do so by reading one reference to national law as meaning laws of an EU member state. And if you look at this reference to national law, that's very consistent with the Montreal Convention that applies in international travel, with U.S. law, with law generally, that the procedures, this procedural law of the form of choice applies. And that's all this is simply saying, redress from courts under procedures of national law. Redress from courts under procedures of the law of that nation. If it was saying more, if it was referencing EU member states only, it would say EU member states. The term EU member states is, or member states specifically, is used 17 times throughout the throughout EU 261 and other contexts. It would be very simple to also say here. And also, as the defendants know, in other EU legislation, national law does mean national law of EU member states, and it does because in those other statutes, it is defined specifically to be limited to that.
Your view would seem to give the EU tremendous authority to undercut our legal principles in the United States and legal policies.
I'm sorry, I don't understand your question.
Well, the EU is by your view, saying that the decision that the United States government has made that there would not be compensation for these delays should be ignored when it's a flight of this type that flies into the United States from one of the EU nations. You take that a little bit further, and all of a sudden the EU can create quite a few causes of action that would not be recognized because of prohibitions and statutes and policies that courts have implemented for many years here.
These are canceled delations and delays on European soil at European airports. They don't affect, EU 261 does not apply to Delta's flights that are taking off from. There's a cancellation or delay in the U.S., EU 261 does not apply to that. It only applies to Delta, to non-member carriers in airports within the EU. So I don't think it would have that impact because this is the law is limited to EU soil. But again, going back to the reference to national law, I think it's, well, for example, if we look at the Kalmich case, which is a Seventh Circuit case, where the Yugoslavian law was applied. and even a Yugoslavian statute of limitation was applied to a claim related to the seizing of property during the Holocaust. And there the court applied both the Yugoslavian statutory law and the Yugoslavian statute of limitations in the U.S. related to activities that happened in Yugoslavia. And this is the same context here.
But there was a basis in American law for that claim.
There was not a... That claim was purely on Yugoslavian law. It was premised on a Yugoslavian tort claim and premised on a Yugoslavian statutory
claim. We have tort law here, too. We don't have this... There's no analog in American law for this regulation. There's not a property law analog. There's not a tort law analog. There's not a contract analog here because it wasn't incorporated into the contract of carriage. So there's no hook in American law for this claim. You're just simply asking us to, without a basis in American law, provide a forum for the enforcement of a code right that exists only in EU member nations. That's unprecedented.
Again, the Yugoslavian law, I don't think there was a related or similar law related to the statutory claim on the Yugoslavian law for seizure of the properties. It was based purely on Yugoslavian law, and I think it's the same basic analysis as here in terms of whether or not, as to what the source law is.
Thank you. Mr. Balassa?
Thank you, Your Honor. Good morning, counsel. May it please the court. On the interpretation of EU 261, the appellant's argument boils down to essentially two propositions. First, the appellants assert that there is a presumption that EU regulations are enforceable by courts outside the EU. Second, the appellants assert that EU 261 is silent on which courts the EU legislature intended to hear claims under the regulation. Both propositions are necessary to the appellant's argument, and on both, appellants are wrong. On the first, there is no presumption under European law that any and every civil court may enforce EU regulations. Whether the EU legislature allowed for extraterritorial enforcement of EU 261 is a question of European law. Appellants, however, cite to no European authority indicating that such a presumption exists. Instead, appellants cite heavily to rulings in which U.S. courts interpret federal statutes and federal regulations, including Galveston, Laker Airways, and Whitman. And some of those cases are addressing questions of federalism and jurisdiction as between federal and state courts, not the issue here. It's inappropriate for the appellants to assert a claim under foreign law and then look to U.S. jurisprudence interpreting federal statutes to determine what the foreign legislature intended. EU jurisprudence, in fact, does not provide for presumptive jurisdiction in civil courts generally. The default rule in the EU is that each member state determines which courts or tribunals may hear claims to enforce in EU regulation. We cite to Impact against Minister for Agriculture and Food, European Court of Justice 2008, at Delta Appendix 83, where the ECJ explained that it, quote, has consistently held that in the absence of community rules governing the matter, it is for the domestic legal system of each member state to designate the courts and tribunals having jurisdiction.
And that's the central adjudicative body in the EU, as I understand it?
The European Court of Justice is the court that has the final say with respect to EU law, as opposed to member state law. And the ECJ stated this same bedrock principle in Peter Breck against Belgium, which we cite at Delta Appendix 189. So under EU jurisprudence, a regulation's silence on the issue of which courts may hear a claim does not mean the EU legislature intended for all civil courts anywhere to hear claims under the regulation. Instead, the EU's default rule is that it's for the member states to decide which civil courts will hear those claims. The appellant's second proposition, that EU 261 expresses no view on foreign enforcement is also incorrect. There are three sections of EU 261 that provide for passengers to enforce the regulation in court. Paragraph 22 of the preamble, Article 16.2, and Article 15. And those provisions, taken individually and collectively, contemplate that the courts enforcing claims under EU 261 will be member state or national courts. Preamble paragraph 22 addresses enforcement of the regulation by two means. One is through administrative bodies, which are called national enforcement bodies, or NEBs, and the alternative is through courts, quote, applying, quote, principles of national law. Now, national law is a term of art in the EU. It doesn't generically mean local courts of any sovereign. It means the law of the member states. And we've cited the court to numerous EU regulations that use the term national law to refer to the laws of member states. We've identified European Commission, that's a chief legislative body, materials addressing EU 261 in particular that expressly use the term national law to mean member state law. These include the European Commission's report from 2011 that appears at DA 5, Delta Appendix 574, and the European Commission's 2013 proposed amendments.
Are there any member state laws that address this kind of situation?
I'm not aware of any member state laws that speak specifically to extraterritorial enforcement, but the appellants
mostly think mostly about delays and that sort of thing within the state. Something that EU 261 addresses. Are there member states that individually have any laws like that, that there may be some cause of action in that member state?
I'm not aware of a conflict between the law of the member states and the law of the European Union. The law of the European Union is supreme, and so if there were an inconsistency, law would control. Notably, the appellants do not cite to a single case or legislative materials that use the term national law to mean anything other than the law of the member states. They do cite to a few materials, European legislative materials, a report prepared for the European Commission in 2010, and another EU regulation, not EU 261, the appellants cite to. And those materials use the term national law repeatedly and refer in those contexts to the law of the member states. So the preamble paragraph 22 means that passengers and air carriers may seek legal recourse from courts applying procedures of member state law, not the law of foreign non-EU jurisdictions. Now, briefly, Your Honors, on Article 16, another provision of EU 261, as the title indicates, that provision addresses infringements or violations of the regulation. And it's important structurally. The first paragraph of Article 16 speaks to the establishment of the national enforcement bodies, the regulatory bodies. The second paragraph of Article 16 concerns passenger recourse for infringements of the regulation, what the plaintiff is doing here. And under Article 16, Paragraph 2, there are two avenues that a passenger may pursue as recourse for infringements of the regulation. Number one, they may, quote, complain to any body designated under Paragraph 1. So that's complaining to the national enforcement bodies. Or in the alternative, 16.2 provides that passengers may complain to, quote, any other competent body designated by a member state. Now, the plaintiffs have taken the position that paragraph 2 allows solely for recourse to national enforcement bodies, and that's mistaken. Since the first clause in 16.2 gives passengers the option of seeking recourse to the national enforcement bodies, the second clause's alternative recourse must refer to something other than recourse to the national enforcement bodies.
Now, do we know whether the EU member states generally authorize under this provision of the regulation and the reference to other competent bodies, do they generally authorize the courts to get involved in adjudicating these claims?
What we know, Your Honor, is that under the impact and Peter Brecht cases I cited from the European Court of Justice, it's up to the member states as a general matter to deter to, and the term those courts use is to designate. It's up to the member states to designate which national courts are going to enforce EU regulations. And so that term designate in 16.2 is meaningful because it's consistent with the principle of EU jurisprudence that it's going to be the member states who are deciding, designating, the, which courts are going to enforce the regulation. And we do have administrative materials. It's the appellants who cited to a report from 2011 to the European Commission that discusses which courts are able to, are enforcing these regulations. And there's a discussion about how small claim courts in member states have been authorized and how that's how that's helpful because it's streamlined procedures.
And that's apparently the general rule in EU member states? That was what my question was getting at. They've generally directed these claims into what would be their our equivalent of small claims courts?
I don't know that it's only small claims courts, but what we do know is there's a general principle that it's up to the member states to determine which courts will enforce regulations, number one. We have EU 261.16.2 saying that these other bodies, the other recourse other than national enforcement bodies, will be those designated by the member states, and that we know as a matter of practice that member states are have designated some courts, including, I don't want to suggest in any way limited to, small claims courts within their jurisdiction.
Do any of them authorize something akin to a class action? I know that's not the general rule from the briefing, but...
The European Union, as a general matter, is hostile to U.S.-style class actions. There are some member state countries that have some procedures for seeking common redress. They are not U.S.-style class actions. For instance, they are opt-in classes. But as a general matter, the materials that we've cited in our briefing show that the EU is hostile expressly to what they call U.S.-style class actions. I'll move along, Your Honors, to preemption. I know there were some questions about whether this claim could have been brought in a state court, and the answer to that under the Airline Deregulation Act is no. A foundation and the first step of our preemption argument and our CAFA argument is that the ADA would preempt a claim under EU 261 if brought in state court. The ADA preemption provision has three requirements.
Well, I hate to get you off track here, but I'd like to hear what you have to say about the Yugoslavian law case that that Mr. Bates referred to, isn't that Kalmyk versus Bruno, and the patent cases and that he cites in his brief. I don't see a response in your brief to those.
Okay. As far as the Yugoslavian case goes, the claim there, being brought there, one of several claims, is a claim for which there is a United States analog, number one. Number two, this issue of whether a foreign legislative body, what the intention of the foreign legislative body was, didn't come up because that was not a statutory case. In the patent cases, I think they were copyright cases, and it is... It seems to be a specialized subject matter.
Right,
there may be a patent case as well, Your Honor. This seems to come up most often in international copyright law. And in those cases, the issue that we're arguing here under the interpretation of EU 261 as far as whether the foreign legislative body intended for extraterritorial enforcement, that apparently wasn't raised by the parties and therefore addressed by the court. So those courts don't address that particular question. Nor do they speak to the preemption issue that I was starting to speak to because preemption was not argued and there wouldn't be, I believe, a basis for arguing preemption in those cases.
But in terms of an analog, there is kind of an American analog in the sense of a breach of contract, right? If you contract with the airline to depart, to get from one place to the other, and the delay is so great that you're really not effectively getting there and so forth, that would be like a breach of contract.
Your Honor's right to point to breach of contract because the whole purpose of the Airline Deregulation Act was to leave it up to the individuals and the airlines and market forces and contracting between individuals and airlines to determine what rights and responsibilities are and to clear away the brush of regulation of the industry. And so it is a breach of contract claim that American law would contemplate someone being able to bring, but for preemption. That is a claim that the appellants first brought. They didn't bring this directly.
So you're saying that really the only analog to which this would compare is one that's preempted.
Correct. And it's one on which the plaintiff did try to bring the claim initially. They lost, and they haven't appealed. So that is that possibility is now gone. On preemption, there are essentially three provisions or three requirements for preemption. One is a state may not enact or enforce. The second is an object of the preemption. The law, regulation, or other provision, you must have a law, regulation, or other provision having the force and effect of law. And the third is a tie to the deregulated subject matter. I see I'm out of, I have just a minute left. But let me point very quickly, because I think Judge Tinder may have asked about whether the courts are preempted or whether laws are preempted. And it's the preclusion under the ADA preemption provision is about states not enacting or enforcing. So it's an action by as it's written by the states, but it's been interpreted repeatedly by this court and the U.S. Supreme Court, this court in Mesa, the First Circuit in Brown, the U.S. Supreme Court recently in Ginsburg, the U.S. Supreme Court in Wolins, as applying equally to federal courts sitting in diversity as to state courts, and that follows from some principles of federalism. I know I'm out of time.
Thank you. Mr. Bates, you were out of time, but I'll give you a minute in rebuttal if you have anything to add.
I'd like to briefly address the arguments and meaning of bodies in Article 16. What Article 16 is addressing is only administrative actions. Throughout the EU 261, bodies and courts are used differently. Bodies is used 8 times. It always references, just as a shorthand, the national enforcement bodies. And when the EU 261 wants to talk about courts, it uses the word courts. Indeed, in one instance, Article 15, it says bodies or courts to make that dichotomy clear. And when, in the second part of Article 16, when they turn to other bodies, and the guidance makes this clear, but what it's saying as a whole is look, if you have a problem and you want to bring an administrative action, it can be brought to the national enforcement body in the country where it occurred. But you could also apply to other bodies, a body of another country as well. So it's limited to bodies. It does not relate to courts.
All right. Thank you.
Thank you.
Our thanks to both counsel. The case is taken under advisement.